Welcome and thank you so much for tuning into the Psychology Is podcast. I'm Nick Fortino and I'm here with my new friend. He's a brave man and he's here to share his personal story. On this podcast, we have covered a variety of topics, but one that we've put some emphasis on is just an assessment of the common practices in psychiatry today and some of the problems with, you know, loose diagnosing of mental disorders and quick prescriptions of psychiatric drugs, often to very young people. And so my new friend, who I will let introduce himself in further detail, actually touched base with me, having come across the podcast and realizing that we've had a lot of experts on. We've had Robert Whitaker, Peter Gutsche, Joanna Moncrief, Kelly Brogan, many pretty well-known experts who have contributed a lot of keen analysis of everything that we're talking about. But you noticed that you were uniquely equipped to fulfill something that was missing in the podcast, which is someone's own story, and offered to tell yours. So thank you so much for doing that and for being here right now.
Awesome. Thanks, Nick. Yeah, so I run a wee personal health blog called Grow Sanctuary on YouTube and Instagram. And I've got a podcast of myself that I'd run as well. And yeah, like I was looking at, I guess I was doing my own research online about all these topics, ADHD, or what I like to call quote unquote ADHD. And Peter, I don't know how you pronounce his last name, Peter
Goetz. I know, he had to correct me about three times. It's pronounced Gutsche.
Gutsche, okay, cool. Yeah, so he's one of the people that I had listened to understand, to learn. And when I was searching online, I came across your podcast and then I saw that you'd interviewed him. So I thought, you're someone who definitely is open-minded to this perspective. And then I looked through some of the other people you'd interviewed, like you just mentioned, Robert Whitaker, Kelly Brogan. I don't know if you've had Peter Bregan, but all those sorts of people I have, you know, huge respect for. I've got Peter's book here, Talking Back to Ritalin. So, yeah, that basically confirmed to me that you'd be someone who would take the right approach when hearing this story. And like you mentioned, you've got all these professionals who are helping raise awareness for what's going on, but none of them have been in the position where it happened to them. And so, yeah, like you mentioned, I am in kind of a unique position where it happened to me, but I've had the resources and the connections to figure out what's happened to me. And I don't see many other people sharing that perspective. So I wanted to reach out and share it.
Beautifully said. Yes. Well, it's an honor to hear your story. And, you know, I know, I hope you don't mind me sharing, that you felt some hesitation about whether you wanted to actually appear and show your face, and here you are. And so I genuinely admire that courage. And let's just remember, you know, as we all listen, because so often personal stories are dismissed as anecdotes and not robust data, but this is a person's story who also speaks on behalf of a growing percentage of people who feel that, in a sense, like you kind of just put it, psychiatry happened to them. There was a gross, like, oversimplification of the complexity of the person's experience and a careless managing of a drug treatment. And so again, I'm not putting like words onto your story here, but I'm just giving people a sense of like who you're representing as you share your story, even though it is, of course, your unique story. So perhaps we can begin by you just describing your first encounter with a psychiatrist and why, you know, that came about at all.
Sure. I just want to quickly respond to what you said there. Yeah, like I did feel a lot of apprehension about doing this because of the potential. I think it's a low risk, but it feels like inside you, it feels like a big risk. You know, there's a lot of stigma around mental health issues. You can be bullied for it. You could be, you know, professionally kind of pushed to one side in some fields. It might affect your ability to work in some places. And that's a very real issue, but it's not going to go away unless we address it, unless we talk about it. So I have to talk about it.
Mm.
So to answer your starting question, basically I was around 8, 9, no older than 9 and a half. I've had to look through all my old medical information and actually email people that aren't in business anymore to try and collect the data for me to put the puzzle together. But that's about as far back as I can trace for when the psychiatry aspect started. So around 8 or early 9. There wasn't any school issues, which is a little bit different to most people. Generally, I think in America, that's where a lot of the diagnosis comes from. So it was more family troubles or whatever. But even within the family, you know, I've come from a slightly, you know, upper middle class background, or at least a comfortable middle class background. So, you know, again, that's people would think that that's less likely to have these issues, and it's sort of true. It is more common with people in, you know, suffering economic hardship with, you know, family problems and things like that. It can make it more likely. But as Peter Bregan's written about in this sort of slightly, you know, middle to upper middle class economic segment of society, it's actually not uncommon, because the parents don't have time. And I think that's where, and they have the money as well. See, because if my parents didn't have the money, there would have been no $400-$500 psychiatry consultant, you know, having several visits. It would never have happened. So in a sense, you know, if you're born into a slightly lower economic sort of part of society, then the problem doesn't happen. It is less likely to happen. But then in those cases, you've got schools coming in, and you've got subsidized medicine coming in. So it's really hard to escape. I mean, anyone can really, it can happen to anyone. So I still to this day don't exactly know what the main thing was, but it was probably just being a troublemaker at home, running around probably more than I should, talking back to people more than I should. Never anything like any sort of violence or domestic issues in that respect, but just like talking back, saying no. So I'll also, although we're talking about ADHD, I actually had two diagnoses. I don't know if I said this in my initial email, but they said I had, even the funny thing is I didn't even know this until earlier this year. Literally the entire time they just told me I had ADHD, but I found the letters and they say he has ODD as well as ADHD. So that's oppositional defiant disorder. Thankfully, there's no drugs for ODD. So I was just given ADHD drugs, but that's part of the saying no sort of stuff, you know, being a defiant child. Yeah, just probably family, lots of family arguments and things like that was probably what started it. But it was probably, I was probably in the low threshold, you know, because that's one of the tricky things with ADHD and discussing it. People can come into this trap from so many different backgrounds. There's so many different possibilities. You could be too aggressive, or you could be too quiet, or you could be too loud. Like, because the diagnosis is so subjective and so pushed, you can find it in almost anybody. I think psychiatrists will probably hate me for saying that, but you can, it's very subjective.
Yes.
That's how I came into it, and they took me because they had the money. The other thing is my mum is a highly qualified industrial psychologist, not clinical, but in like businesses, corporations and whatnot. And so all of her colleagues from university, well, not all of them, but a percentage of them were in the clinical psychology field. And she's obviously well read on those topics. So that, I think, also kind of prepared the ground for what ended up happening. She had the background in it. We had the money. It just naturally happened. So, well, we wanted to get the best treatment, best help. So I think it would have been a psychologist first and then a psychiatrist. And I think there was more than one psychiatrist. And I do remember it being very uncomfortable to be put in some huge, expensive flash office on your own. You know, that's another weird trick they do. They kind of separate the parents from the children. They bring you in together, then they do like the child on their own, then the parents on their own, then back together. And sort of like, it's almost like you're being questioned for something that you've done wrong. You know what I mean? And they're trying to, and you don't know what the other people are saying. So it's kind of weird that they do that. And you're being looked at and people are taking notes, studied as if you're sort of some, you know, something, there's something really wrong with you. So that's sort of starting the stigmatization very early on. I probably rambled a bit, so maybe go to your next point.
Well, you're not rambling at all. This is the level of detail I was hoping you would share, and I appreciate it. And maybe just to put into perspective even more for people, when you talk about how subjective these diagnoses are, I thought I would read off just straight from my PDF version of the DSM-5, the current edition of the Book of Mental Disorders, just some of the criteria for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and perhaps even provide people with a little bit of context. So I don't want this podcast episode to be as informational as much as I want it to be personal. However, here is, I think, helpful information. The construct of ADHD appeared for the first time in the revised edition of the DSM-3 in 1987. The first edition of the DSM in 1952 did not include any version of this, and then the second one in 1968 included the initial description of what would eventually become ADHD. It was known as hyperkinetic impulse disorder. And then in 1980, the DSM-3 came out, which included ADD. And then during the next 7 years, the APA generally agreed that hyperactivity is inherent in this condition. So in the revised edition of the DSM-3 in 1987, ADHD appeared for the first time. And so the diagnosis of this condition rose steadily throughout the 80s and 90s, but has dramatically risen in the past 20 years. And I just want to give, so there's some historical context, and to give some context around exactly what this condition is, what the symptom criteria are, here are some. So basically, it's defined as a persistent pattern of inattention and or hyperactivity or impulsivity that interferes with functioning or development. And there are two aspects to it: inattention, so attention deficit, and hyperactivity. And interestingly, you only have to meet the criteria for one of them to get the diagnosis of ADHD. So for inattention, you have to have six or more of the following symptoms, having persisted for at least 6 months to a degree that is inconsistent with developmental level and that negatively impacts your life. And then there are a list of, I think it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 possible. Nine possible symptoms, right? And I'll just read off about three in the interest of time here. So one, often fails to give close attention to details or makes careless mistakes in schoolwork, at work, or during other activities. Often does not seem to listen when spoken to directly. Often avoids, dislikes, or is reluctant to engage in tasks that require sustained mental effort. And those are just three. There are nine total. You have to meet six of them. or 5 if you're an adult, actually, but 6 if you're under 17. And if you do, you qualify for a diagnosis. And then there are symptoms listed that describe hyperactivity, like often fidgets with or taps hands or feet or squirms in seats, or often unable to play or engage in leisure activities quietly, or often has difficulty waiting his or her turn. So you can hear in the language that there's room for interpretation, a lot of room for interpretation. And that is just cannot be, you know, overstated here. The fact that there's so much room for interpretation about what often means, or whether or not this behavior being described, like that the person doesn't appear to be listening when being spoken to directly, making the judgment about whether that is truly happening and whether it is, you know, abnormal, it's up to the person diagnosing. And I also, you know, I don't mean to talk too much here, this is about you, but when I read the DSM, I acknowledge that it's a very, very well thought out, carefully made document. And I think it has some value. It's helpful. It's valuable to identify patterns of behavior. And indeed, patterns of behavior cluster together. And no doubt that probably is reflective of personality dispositions or maybe neurological profiles. But that's not, you know, that's not all the DSM is. The DSM is used as a medical tool to help diagnose people with these disorders. So it's more than just making keen observations and collecting data around patterns of human behavior. It's used for more than that. And then perhaps what is kind of most problematic of all is the fact that we don't really know what is causing these patterns of behavior, but we treat these conditions as if we know exactly what's causing these patterns of behavior, and we don't. So that's all I wanted to say. There's so much more that can be said, of course, but I just wanted to provide listeners that context and now come back to you and your story. So you were about 9 years old. You we're not necessarily.
I'll take it from there.
Thank you.
I just wanted to add a few things, and one that I forgot to say at the beginning. Like you said, this is more of a personal story, like details, you know, case information, rather than an informational podcast episode. But if people want to look into, you know, the informational stuff, if they're not well read on that before listening to this, I will send you some links of my favorite articles, and I'm sure you've got your own. And I think, well, it's good if we include that in the description. You know, there's some from Fred Bauman, Peter Bregan, Robert Whitaker, you mentioned. Madden America has a few articles. I think it is important because I'm not perfect at explaining all the nitty gritty things that they do. I'm kind of more like the bird's eye view, putting all the pieces together. I don't understand. You know, I have been to university, but I didn't study science. So I don't have that unique understanding of the neurons and all that sort of stuff. I also wanted to point out, when you're mentioning the 6 of 9, right? You need 6 of the 9 mm-hmm. symptoms. I remember there's a quote from I think it's the 1998 consensus conference on ADHD that was held in America. And someone put their hand up and said, I have a lot of trouble with this sub-threshold for diagnosis. I can't remember what exact wording he said, but basically, if you've got 5, you're okay. But once you get the 6th, you have a brain disorder. You know, it just defies common sense and logic, the way that they do this. And then, as you mentioned, it's incredibly subjective. And then they almost never look at other possible causes for those clusters of behaviors and characteristics. They go straight to the drug. Which is obviously what happened to me. So yeah, I went to one psychologist, I think 2 psychiatrists. You know, they insisted that my parents give me this medication, Ritalin. In my case, it was Ritalin. I also took Concerta, 1 or 2 different kinds of Concerta in later years, but it was Ritalin initially. And I was incredibly against taking it. Maybe that was just my, you know, defiant child
your ODD
behavior, or maybe it was some, you know, divine intuition that I knew it was bad for me. But I spat it out. I caused more arguments, refusing to take it, threw it on the ground. And the first time I did take it, my mum actually forced it into my mouth with a, like, squeezed it into a piece of, like, a corner of a piece of bread, which up until now, up until I realized all this stuff, I thought that was just a minor detail. But now I'm realizing that as a child, as an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old, that it would have been 9 then, would have been incredibly traumatic. And also for my brother, who was there and saw it as well, because he would have thought, fuck, am I next? Sorry, I shouldn't have sweared.
No, but you can. You're allowed to swear.
He would have thought, oh, my God, could this happen to me? Because he's my younger brother. And he remembers it vividly as well. I didn't have to explain it or remind him when I brought that up. So once you're on it for a few days, though, the numbness, that's probably if I had to pick one word, it would just be like soul numbing, if that's even a word, soul-numbing. Like, that's the feeling that it gives, and you just become less and less resistant the longer you're on it. And that's why you end up with people who are on it for a long period of time. And they even say, I think there's a quote in this book from Peter Breggin where he actually quotes some of the pro-drug scientists and psychiatrists who call it the amphetamine look, which is like they actually describe the look on children's face after they've been on it for a while, like there's actually a look that they give. And another thing that clicked for me once I realized all this was when I was in primary school, a girl I knew said to me, "You just look so gormless." And I never, at that time, I thought, why? What are you on about? And that really clicked as well, because that's kind of what gormless is. Like, it's like a plain, like, zombie-like, you know, facial expression. So I had all that. I started to eat a lot less, which is a well-known side effect, the appetite suppression. I think there's actually some people who use it for weight loss. And as an adult, you know, you're much less likely to suffer the harmful side effects, but no doubt there will be harmful side effects of doing that. So that's an issue for anyone who's, you know, who's using it for that reason to consider. But so I was eating a whole lot less, but my parents nor I were ever warned about any of these side effects that I'm going to start going through. Never, any of them. And I've got I had to chase them down, like via email and phone calls. I found the clinic that was one of the people that prescribed these for me, and could you send all the consultation notes that you had from our time? None of them ever went over none of the notes or letters ever covered the side effects. It's possible that they did it verbally, very possible, but I have a feeling that my parents or I would have said, hey, if it has a side effect of suicidal thoughts, no thanks. But that obviously that never happened. And I'll get more onto that in a moment. But so first up was not eating as much, appetite suppression. My mum used to joke, call me the lizard, because I would just like take ages to eat dinner. Just like take like an hour and just not eat dinner. And I was a lot less developed than my younger brother. I mean, I'm above average in height. I'm 6 foot, you know, 184 centimeters. But compared to my family, I'm the shorter side and less developed. Like my brother's over 2 meters, my dad's almost 2 meters. And so that's one of the other tricks that Peter Breggin often mentions, that these people will say, oh, look, the child's fine. They're above average in height. But you don't know what their potential was. Mm. You don't know. It's not taking into account their family. You know, it's just another silly thing that people say.
It's interesting.
So yeah. I wasn't eating enough. And I was also called bony because, like, you could just see, like, my rib cage and everything. I was just under – I was just, like, wasn't putting on weight. But that didn't raise any alarm bells from anybody, unfortunately. And it continued. I developed extremely cold hands, which they do list Raynaud's syndrome and peripheral coldness as side effects of Ritalin and most of the other ADHD medications. I mean, if people haven't already had a look, we'll link that below as well. But the list is huge. The list is so long. And a lot of them, they say, are extremely rare. But that's because I would say they're underreported. I never reported any of my side effects, even though now in hindsight, looking back, you know, over a decade, I can know that I'm pretty sure that was what was happening.
Right.
But I never reported it at the time. So my information will never have been included into the statistics used to say that it's extremely rare. The most rough side effect, and I think this is the thing that made me want to share this story the most, was it gave me suicidal thoughts and self-harm. I would bang my head on the wall and punch myself in the head. That's pretty brutal. And, you know, part of me thinks I shouldn't be sharing that on the internet. But again, like, you know, this could save some child's life out there who's going through the exact same thing. And I feel like I have a duty to them to help them. So yeah, punching myself in the head and banging my head on the wall. And my mum, because she's got this, she's a good person, but you know, because she has this psychology background, this very academic psychology background, rather than the sort of natural response, it was that, well, that's an attention seeking thing, which it does say in some of the ADHD books, because we still have them. I'm tempted to chuck them in the fire one day, but if I'm at go back to my family home, but the books, they say things like that the children, the ADHD child will exaggerate things for attention. So that's what that got put down to. And then I think I eventually got taken to another psychologist and they said they wanted to add on I was OCD, I think, obsessive compulsive. I don't know if they said obsessive compulsive disorder, but they said I was obsessive about the sport that I was doing. So again, they just pathologize. Like, normal behaviors are pathologized and then the unhealthy behaviors are just explained away as a brain disorder. So yeah, where should we go to from there?
Yes. I mean, what's so nice about this story, I must say, is that you're just kind of naturally also providing very helpful information. You know, it's just implicit in your story. So I appreciate just everything I'm learning, you know, like just, for example, that little piece that, you know, when you examine and see, okay, is this child under height? No, they're not. But actually their personal potential was like 6'3". But anyway, so you're providing a lot of good information as you share your story. And yeah, just thank you for what you said about the potential that, you know, you could save a child who is on the trajectory that you are on. So tell me, if you would, like, what was it like to have these suicidal thoughts? What prevented you from ever acting on them?
Yeah, so, and I'll also just add, not just saving children's lives. I mean, there's adults that are probably on these as well, I think. And an adult could be even more likely to eventuate with, you know, something suicidal because they might have the means to do so compared to a child. So what was it like? And I'll also just add that people have died of these, like, 100% guaranteed that even as early as the 1990s, I'm actually looking to interview the mother of one of those children on my podcast, but she's a bit busy at the moment. But yeah, so having those thoughts, it was bad because I thought there was something wrong with me because that's the story I've been told since I was 8. I had no idea it was the drugs, kept taking them. And I was on twice a day, so a morning dose and then half in the afternoon. You know, it almost feels like comical just to look back at it. Like, I would be there getting, like, on the, you know, on a wooden chopping board, cutting my little Ritalin thing in half. Like it just, why should a child ever be cutting up Ritalin and then swallowing it? Like, because the doctor said so. And if I was at school, I would have the the thing all prepared in a film canister, an empty film canister, and when no one was looking, before, you know, when in a break of sports or something, I'd be swinging it down. Like, and that's another thing that the, you know, my mind, I feel like it's something I feel like it's by design that the psychiatrists and stuff tell people not to tell anybody about it. They actually say that. They say not to tell anyone. Well, they try to encourage people not to tell anyone about it because they're concerned that you'll be bullied, which is a real concern. But I think it's also part of the trap, because if I had told anybody, you know, if you tell 100 people half of the story as an 11-year-old, you'll get like 30 to 40%, probably 60%. Who knows how many will say, maybe the first thing you need to do is get off these drugs. You know what I mean? That'll be most people's first recommendation. But because I never said it to anybody, it just continued. So on your question, having those thoughts, yeah, it was painful. It's a form of, I guess, psychosis or something. You know, like you genuinely hate yourself. Another funny, it's not funny, but a coincidence or a sort of a neat fact that I found out was when I was reading Peter Bregan's other book, Ritalin Fact Book, he has a quote in there of what a child was who he saw was saying to himself. And it was something along the lines of, I wish I was dead. And that was one of the same things that I used to say to myself. And I thought that was interesting because, you know, we're in the same, you know, English speaking world, but they're over in, you know, Northeast United States and I'm here in New Zealand, but and both, you know, young boys, but we both form the same sentence or a similar sentence from this drug. I mean, to think that's a coincidence is just insane in my mind. So that was rough, but the suicidal thoughts and self-harm didn't last. It wasn't super long. It was, well, probably the thoughts were probably a longer term thing than the actual harm. The harm thing, I think I just got tired of it and just stopped doing it naturally, not because I came off the drugs. I was still on them. But and just another point on that, because to me that was the most egregious example of this sort of corruption going on. I did a lot of digging into this, and I found that the New Zealand government, and I've got the document saved on my computer and a hard drive, is that from 2003 or 2004, they just had in the material or the data sheet for I think they were talking about, they were referring to Concerta, which is just another name for methylphenidate. You know, it's a slightly different formulation, different company or different product, but it's effectively the same, very, very similar. They had in the data sheet for Concerta in around 2003 or 2004 that it can cause suicidal behaviours. And that was, and then they had it, that was as early as I could see it being introduced into the data sheet, because the data sheet gets renewed every year or every second year. So my medication started around that time, 2002, maybe 2003. And so the psychiatrist in question and the GPs are general practitioners, like your family doctor in New Zealand, the GPs, psychiatrists, psychologists, in my mind, they should have known that, you know, just to be up to date with their own, you know, government regulations, their own government data. And maybe they were, but they chose to withhold that information. So either they chose to withhold it, which I think is unlikely, because I don't think anyone would do anything that harmful deliberately, or they just didn't know. But why didn't they know? You know, you're giving this stuff to children. It's, you've got to be more careful.
Right. Right. Gosh, this just affects me so much. And as I listen to you, thoughts come to my mind about how sometimes I really am careful not to speak in a way that is too extreme. and to acknowledge that sometimes these drugs are helpful, but then it's also like, I would never want to underdo it because we have to speak so passionately against this because it is so common that children are being prescribed very serious drugs such as Ritalin and Adderall. And what you are sharing here, you speak on behalf of many people of many ages, and this is so serious. And the problem, I think, is the perception of these drugs as being medication and not just drugs, but they're drugs, they're psychoactive substances. It's not like you're giving insulin to someone who has diabetes. It's not like you're giving their body something that it needs. You're just producing a pharmacological effect on this developing child's brain. And your story just really...
I definitely don't want to be inflammatory to people who at this point in time are taking it. You know, it doesn't help anybody if we get, you know, argumentative amongst a group of people that are pretty much all on the same page. We just want the best outcomes for everyone. It's unhelpful to be, you know, say, you know, you shouldn't be on it, don't be on it, you know, things like that. You're not going to reach someone like that anyway. But like you said, at the same time, so in different contexts, we can be more soft about it. But yeah, I mean, in my case, speaking about it right now, I'm totally comfortable saying it the way I've said it because it's what happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
And another way to sort of soften it is that, look, if you're an adult taking this, you know, these medications, then I would say you're a lot less at risk of things happening because you've depending on the age you started, but if you started after 18 or then your body and brain develop. So roughly normally, quote unquote, no one's normal, but so you're going to have less issues than a child. And I think you can sort of, there's different ways you can, you know, divide up this broad topic. And I think the most important message should be around the children, because at least in the case of an adult, every adult on the planet that has access to a phone or a computer they're not going to be fully informed by their doctor or psychiatrist, in my opinion. They're never going to get fully informed consent because how many psychiatrists tell them that it can cause suicidal thoughts? I don't know. But at least they can potentially inform themselves because they have access to the internet, right? But even then, if you don't know where to look, you won't find this information. This is a tangent. I'm getting off topic. But on any of the ADHD forums, they rubbish this information, and it's offensive how strict they are on sharing. Like they just say that Peter Regan is anti-psychiatry, therefore don't listen to him, and therefore don't post anything about him. So if you don't know where to look, you won't find this. But at least if you're an adult, there's a chance that you will find this information. But a child, I mean, children have phones nowadays, but their chance of finding it is so low. And if they're drugged at a young age, they will be zombified. And, you know, we're supposed to look out for them. The adults in society are supposed to look out for them. So yeah, I think it's okay to be a lot more strong about this topic when you're talking about it in the case of children.
Great point. So how many years total were you taking Ritalin?
Yeah, roughly, so 9 till 18, and then on and off around, let me think, 19, 20, around the age 21 to 22, but yeah, it was kind of inconsistent then.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so in a moment, I want to talk about when you were 18 and then again when you were 22, when you decided to come off of it and then what happened after that. But before we get into that, a few more questions about, you know, your experience with the drugs and your experience of having the diagnosis kind of attached to you. So first of all, did you raise any of these concerns, like the suicidality and any other behaviors like that, to the psychiatrist? And did you link it to the drug?
So the main, when at least in New Zealand, the way it worked for me was I would see the GP, the family doctor, on a semi-regular basis, maybe once every couple of months. And they would give me updated prescriptions to go and get the Ritalin from pharmacy. So I wouldn't see the psychiatrist maybe once a year, if that, maybe once every 2 years. I kind of need to go through the letters again and check the exact number, but I think in many cases, there were many years where I didn't see them. It would have just been once every 2 years. And then there were some years where it might have been two in 1 year, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And no, I never raised. The only issue I raised, because even back then I was good at researching on the computer, and I had found that there was this issue of height, because as growing up as a boy, that was the thing that annoyed me the most at the time. Even though then I wasn't actually that short, but I just felt like I could be taller. And to me, now it's not a big deal. Like I'm tall enough, but
mm-hmm.
So I looked that up and I found that there was the height growth suppression. And I did mention that to the doctor and my parents and the psychiatrist, because that was the one I knew about that they admitted online that I could find. And they would always just say, well, when you come off, something along the lines of, oh, it's sort of temporary. And when you come off, you sort of make up for it, and something along those lines, which is sort of true if you have a proper medication holiday, like several months off, but I never did. So, but I never brought up the suicidality or anything like that, which is insane to think about now that I never brought that up, but I had no idea. I just thought, wow, I'm just a messed up person. I've been told I have this disorder. I've seen shrinks at the age of 8 and 9. I'm a messed up person. But I never brought it up with them.
It's so amazing to me the way that what you just shared about the fact that you were seeing your general physician more frequently, and they were the ones who were renewing your prescription, in essence, being the ones who were confirming that you still need to be on this, which should require some examination of behavior. But in my opinion, psychiatrists don't even have enough psychology education, because they go through medical school and then they go to a psychiatry residency and probably learn a lot, at least in a certain context. But general practitioners don't study psychology at all in graduate school. And they are now in that position, because that still happens. This is a common trend where the GP is writing prescriptions, renewing prescriptions, and they're not even, I don't even think they would claim to be qualified to examine behavior and confirm that this drug treatment needs to continue. So that stands out to me. And then, you know, the other thing I want to ask you about, you mentioned something right before we officially started, was the phrase you said was, they create an identity for you. So can you talk to me more about the diagnosis and how that impacted you psychologically?
Yeah, sure. Also, just to answer your point there about the GP thing, I might not be getting it exactly right, the intricacies of how psychiatrists and GPs work with the government and pharmacies to do the diagnosis and prescription process here in New Zealand. But it works something like, I think the psychiatrist gets you what's called a special authority number, which is kind of like a special application to have access to these special medications. And then the GP kind of just facilitates the ongoing prescriptions, but that special authority number kind of lapses eventually. Maybe it's 1 year or 2 years or 18 months, and then you kind of have to go back to them to get a renewal of that. I think that's roughly how it works. But I agree with what you're saying, that none of them are really educated enough to be doing it. And the doctors, the family physicians, all they really said was like, are you feeling good on it? You know, how are your grades at school? And I had good grades, not the best, but well above average, and quite good in some subjects. So they always just continued it. With the identity thing, what I was referring to is, like, if you're told something from such a young age that you have this condition, especially something that's invisible. I mean, it's not invisible even in their mind. Like they're what they're implying is that there's something different in your brain. So it's not saying that it's invisible, but it's invisible to our eyes unless you use machines. So whereas if it was something, you have this shoulder condition and then you worked on it and it slowly went away, then it couldn't really be as much part of your identity. But when it's something invisible in your brain, you have almost no way of refuting it unless you read up Peter Bregan's book or something like that. So yeah, it naturally becomes part of your identity. And I think what I was referring to before we started recording was, I think, and I wish the best for everyone. I hope everyone gets what they want and improves. And I don't mean this in a negative way at all, but I think some people, when they hear this information, they do feel like it's an attack on them personally, because it's like what we are saying and what Robert Whittaker, Fred Bauman, Peter Bregan, Michael Corrigan, what these people are saying is challenging a part of that person's identity. It's challenging the validity of a part of these people's identity. And I would have reacted badly to that as well if someone had said all this information to me back then. And I probably did. I was very skeptical when I first heard it, because you accept the diagnosis and then you use it to explain lots of other things around you. And like one anecdote that I can remember that's kind of funny is I was fully duped into believing that it was part of me, never questioned it. But I knew that it had a negative connotation. The word disorder is to the best of my knowledge, it's a pejorative. It can only have a negative connotation. There is no situation where disorder means a positive thing. Mm. So a child's, whether you know pejorative and connotation as a child, you might not know those words, but you understand that disorder is a negative thing. So you have something that is inherently negative that is part of you. That's not a good thing. And then I remember that there was a few times when I would try and say to my parents, like, my brother, so-and-so, isn't there a chance that he has it as well? And the logic there was that I was trying to, in hindsight, what I see now is that I was trying to feel less bad about it by, other people have it too, eh? There's other people with this thing that's wrong with them as well, eh? The other really sick thing about the identity is that they imply that it's genetic in some situations. And in my case, they implied that it was from my dad. And so my relationship with him, like, I had a dad. People grow up without dads, and everyone should be grateful for what they have and everything. But, and so I'm not making excuses or anything, but that caused a lot of negativity, because it's basically like, I got this negative trait from you. And yeah, that whole time growing up, I could have been learning a lot from my dad, and I still did. I still have good memories, but I could have been doing a lot more. And I know that the fact that I thought that he had passed on this to me, was a sense of division, or a lack of connectedness or disconnectedness between us. And I know, I think that happened to my parents as well, because probably from my mum's perspective, it was like, my mum, they're happily married still and everything, but like she probably would have thought, and I think I overheard her saying this in certain situations that, you got it from him. And then I think they even stretched it to try and say that my dad got it from his dad. Like these are such massive stretches of the imagination to claim with such little proof. But like I mentioned, my mum had the very academic psychology background. we have other nurses in the extended family and a few doctors. And so, like my dad's brother, my godfather is also a psychologist, and with a lot of experience and like award-winning and psychologist. And so I think all these factors in my situation contributed to it, because it was just very valid to everyone involved. It was just a very valid thing. Well, you know, these things exist. Psychology is real. And I believe psychology is real, but I mean, sorry, psychiatric disorders in children are real. And yeah, I think all those factors contributed to the idea that, you know, it's a part of who you are.
Mm.
And I think I'm probably rambling a little bit again, but there's articles online about where people try and, it's weird, people are trying to cope with this idea that they have been given this negative label, a disorder. And there's articles saying, oh, you know, here are these famous people through history that we believe might have had ADHD. And here are these CEOs, you know, there's some statistics around people in different positions in society that have ADHD and things like that. And, you know, some of them are probably true and some of them are not. But it's like there's so much effort going into protecting people's feelings about the idea that, oh, you have a disorder. And so trying to cushion it by saying, oh, all these other impressive people had it too. So don't feel too bad about it. Don't question it too much. That's another thing I noticed.
That's a great observation. Yes. Yeah, what a just clear, insightful look into the psychology of being diagnosed. And I think you're absolutely right that the word disorder is innately pejorative. Yeah. There, like you said, there's no situation where that means something positive. And so to feel like you, something about you is inherently negative, I can only imagine, and you're helping me imagine what that might be like. I have several questions. So one, let's just kind of fast forward to kind of nowadays. Have your parents changed their mind in as you have changed your mind and your paradigm and your understanding of all of this?
Yeah, it's a good topic to bring up. The short answer is no. I didn't really bring it up that much until probably late last year, when I sort of had all my information kind of lined up and I thought I could make a convincing case to prove my point, including citations from scientific studies and people who are respectable in that industry. And I think it's just a case of like, it hurts. It's like, you know, people don't want to feel, I'm not a parent yet. And I think a parent hearing this, it's not going to be a nice feeling. It's like you made a quite a big mistake, and everyone makes mistakes, but this is kind of a big one, because there's so many reasons it's wrong. And, you know, there's the intellectual reason, there's the chemical element of the drugs, there's the insult by being told you have a disorder. There's the cost of everything that you think you potentially missed out on. I can imagine it's not a nice feeling, but yeah, it hasn't gone down well. my mum, yeah, she's still like, because she knows she's in that field, so she when I tried to present it to her, she just connected with some of her classmates, I think, and they said that no, the side effects stop once the drugs have been stopped, which is just quite easily proved wrong. My dad's kind of open-minded to it, but I think it's just like, it's just unfortunate and sad to think about, so it's just sort of like not really wanting to talk about it. Pretty bad reactions in some cases, like, you don't know science, you know, you're not qualified to make those claims. those scientists that do say it, or those qualified people are fringe. You know, there's every number of excuse that can be made to think that this information is wrong. So that's unfortunate. But, you know, I believe it could change one day.
Yes. I'll believe that with you. And I hope so. So tell me about what gave you kind of the empowerment to decide to stop. And then it sounds like when you stopped at the age of 18, you had another short stint with it. So perhaps you could reflect on stopping.
Yeah. So 18, there wasn't really any logic in stopping then. It was just sort of like, oh, I'm going to university. I don't feel like taking it. You know, you kind of have a different schedule at university. It's not as early morning starts, although I was an early morning person in high school. I had lots of sports stuff on before school, but yeah, I don't know, just with my schedule and just a feeling, I just chose not to have it. I hadn't woken up to anything at all. And obviously having it for 9 years prior, the residual effect was super strong then. So I was basically the same person. It wasn't like it's a changed person getting off it. I lived overseas for a year in my second year of uni. And yeah, when I got back, I had to go to the psychiatrist for, like, this time was, I mean, as an adult, I sort of went myself because I thought that I was doing the right thing. Like I went for antidepressants, and that was only like a couple of months, and they then had me on sleeping pills because it was messing with my sleep, and that was when it all just like clicked to me that this whole like chemical thing was just, it's got to stop. And so yeah, around 21 or 22, that was when I was still in the later stages. I had done a few months on, 2 or 3 months on antidepressants, which ended with like the sleeping pill, and that was when it all clicked. Like, there's something really wrong. I didn't know any of the Peter Briggan stuff, but I just knew I needed to stop, and that this was, you know, I was being farmed, or I was being conned. I had to stop, and it was kind of just too much. So I got off it, and I had already been a healthy person in terms of eating, exercise, screen time, and all that stuff. And so nothing really changed in my diet, but I just realized I needed to take off, get out of all that, all those drugs, the medications. I think it's better to call it medications, because if you say drugs, then people might flip it and be like, oh, he's talking about something else. But I'm talking about medications. So the antidepressant, sleeping pill. The sleeping pill, yeah, it was like the last straw. I was only on it for like less than a month, but I just realized I'm on three things right now. What the F is going on? How can this be the best option?
Wow.
And the funny thing is, those are all, not funny, but those are all well-known side effects, right? Sleep, and that's another thing I didn't mention earlier on when I was going through childhood side effects, sleep problems. Like I really, really struggled to get sleep. Thankfully, back in my day, we didn't have smartphones, so I was just reading, and that was probably beneficial for me. But I had a lot of struggles getting to sleep. And so insomnia is listed as a side effect of Ritalin. And then the antidepressant angle, well, depression is a side effect of Ritalin, I think. Or, you know, depressive mood, right?
Mm.
And so that naturally followed. And then the insomnia from the Ritalin, then you're on the sleeping pills.
Oh, my gosh.
But I mean, this is not the worst it could have been. Like, I've heard stories in America. America seems to have the worst of the worst for this psychiatry stuff. But I've heard from some of Peter Briggan's work that he's had kids on two or three things at the same time. under 10-year-olds on two or three psychiatric medications at the same time. So I think, that's much worse.
It's one thing to prescribe a drug for a period of time that is longer than the experiments that allowed it to hit the market in the first place, because that happens. But it's quite another to do that extended length of time that we really now is the first experiment of, in combination with multiple medications. That is just, I don't know even what the word would be for that. I want to say criminal, but I don't want to be inflammatory. But really, how does a psychiatrist justify that? I don't think there is a valid justification for that. Again, just thank you for sharing this.
It's weird. I don't want to be inflammatory either, but I feel like that industry, that profession seems to attract a certain type of person, like a certain type of person who can emotionally detach themselves from the outcome. And, that's a good thing to have in sports and some other competitive things, but like not when you're dealing with someone's like life and someone's health. And because I emailed one of the places that was prescribing me, one of the psychiatrist things, I wasn't really interested in what they recommended, but I wanted to see what they would say. Like I gave them all the data and the evidence and said, like, hey, I'm not blaming you guys, but could you see, like, is it possible to book an appointment for, you could recommend where you could point me in the direction, like where could you point me in the direction for healing from these substances? And the emails just got shut down, like, no, sorry, not even a sorry, like, no, we can't help you, there's nothing more we have to say about this. And that was the receptionist. But it's like, how can you suck someone's money from them and then the inevitable happens and then just be like, no, I don't want to hear about it, and then redo the whole thing again? And the thing is, it's increasing. Like you said at the start, like the numbers of children getting put on psychiatric medication is increasing. So we know it's bad, but we're doing more of it. You know, it'd be one thing if we just kept doing the same amount, but we're actually increasing it. It's just nuts.
I know a lot of drug dealers with the work I do. I know a lot of people who deal drugs. Illegal drugs in the US, such as methamphetamine. And I swear everyone I know won't deal to kids. And that honestly shows me that the drug dealer, I mean, the human being, I don't want to create all these labels and dehumanize them, but this human being that I meet who is sitting in a jail for dealing a lot of drugs is operating at a higher ethic than medical doctors prescribing multiple drugs to children. But of course they're not thinking of it in the same way.
Yeah,
but it's way more similar to, you know, like the drugs are much more similar than people tend to think. And so you would be appalled if you met a drug dealer in jail who said, yeah, I deal drugs to kids, whoever's willing to buy, I'll deal. You would be appalled by that. But we are not appalled enough, in my opinion, by medical doctors and particularly psychiatrists who are prescribing or dealing, but I'll say prescribing, drugs to children.
Yeah, it's there's definitely, I mean, to argue in good faith, like most of them think they're doing the right thing.
Yes.
But there must be a few that know that there's a problem, but choose to just look the other way. Whether it's for the money, whether it's for the career, I don't know. But there's no way that 100% of them all think that they're doing the right thing. It just is not true. Mm. And like the thing is, you, it's not just like, have you heard of, like, I'm not into the Church of Scientology or whatever, but have you heard of there's that group, CCHC or whatever that,
yes,
what are they called?
I wish I could remember, but they consider themselves like a watchdog over psychiatry.
Yeah. And
the Center for Human Rights.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And they've done group. They've got a group in New Zealand and in a few countries, and they've like there's many sorts of bad things that happen with the psychiatric industry. Yeah. There's issues where people have tried to start relationships with their patients. There's been cases of torture. Like there's a thing in New Zealand people can look up. It's called like Lake Alice Royal Inquiry. Basically, it's so gross. I don't even want to go into it. But like, it was psychiatry was involved with it. Like people who were told they had like mental disorders. This was even worse in the old days. It was like in the 70s or something, and they were taken there, and they were often like people from broken families, like orphans, or only had one parent, or their parents were in jail or something. And, yeah, not good. But it just seems to continually pop up. It's like a recurring theme. And there are great psychiatrists out there. Like it's a continuum, just like anything else. Like there's Free Range Psychiatry is one, and I think they're in like New Hampshire or Vermont. And there's other good ones like Peter Bregan. But it seems like the vast majority are just not really interested in another solution. I think psychologists are a lot better on average. So like there's one in New Zealand actually in University of Canterbury who's been looking into vitamins and minerals, or basically like a nutritional approach to ADHD and I think other disorders as well, which is good. But the thing that I would get into there is like there's many ways to divide up this topic. One of them is the harmful nature of the drugs themselves. I think that's like the easy level. That's the easy level. Pretty much everyone can agree on that. Pretty much everyone can agree that there's something there. But at a higher level, there's the question of, this lady at the University of Canterbury, I don't think she quite goes this far, but like I'm like Peter Bregan and Fred Bauman and Robert Whittaker and Peter Gitch or whatever, and I challenge the idea that there is a disorder to begin with, you know. And I think people, like it's a bit disingenuous to call it a half-truth, but there's a lot of people out there that promote, oh yeah, the drugs are bad, you just need therapy, or the drugs are bad, you need this natural treatment, or this holistic, you need this diet, or you need to heal your gut, and things like that are good. But I believe that if people are willing to and open-minded and stuff to question the premise that there is anything wrong with your brain to begin with, because there's not actually that much evidence that there is. And all of the evidence that there is, some of it is questionable. There's a page in here called the brain scan scam. Where the children they used in one particular study to show the differences in brains between children who have ADHD and children without it. Both groups, or the group that they said had ADHD had also been on psychiatric medication.
Oh my gosh.
So
that is like a confounding variable.
Yeah. And I'm sure that's just the tip of the iceberg. I'll include the links for people to follow up on this, this information. But and the other thing is, I'm ranting again, but like there may be differences in the brain. There may be differences in the brain, but what if they're things that are beneficial in certain circumstances?
Yes.
Right? It's only because of our modern society that we decide to label. Like you can look at the same trait in a negative and a positive way. Like you could say, I'm not thinking of a really good example here, but you could say that someone who can't focus on something that is boring, you could say, or that they think is boring, you could call that a bad thing. Or you could say that the flip side is that they are hyper interested in the things, or they can hyper focus on things that they are interested in.
Mm. And like, a healthy lack of tolerance for anything that's irrelevant.
Yeah.
I agree with you. The context, it's almost like there's nothing wrong with the puzzle piece if it's just in the wrong puzzle.
Yeah, and it's like you could say that, like, in maybe a future version of the world, like a beautiful, healthy version of the world, like we might actually, I don't think we would do this, but you could go, oh, this person actually, we wouldn't say they have a disorder, but this person's a little bit too narrow-minded. We could call narrow-mindedness a disorder if we wanted to. Or right. We could call blind obedience a disorder if we wanted to. We could call insistence of following the old-fashioned way, we could call that a disorder if we wanted to, or if the people right. in power wanted to. But at the way it currently is, these certain behaviors are deemed bad.
Mm.
But it's just that they've been deemed bad.
Deemed. Like,
we could do that to some other behavior.
Right. Right.
Like there's an article from, what's his name? I was reading it. Thomas Armstrong, 17 Reasons Why I Believe ADHD Is Not a Legitimate Medical Disorder. That's a really good article, and he's got a video to go with it. It goes into some of the other possible explanations. Mm. You know, just boyish behavior, for example, is a factor that leads to increased rates of ADHD diagnosis. Mm. So perhaps it's just boys being, in some cases, boys just being a little bit more aggressive and more active. And they're not being given enough playtime outside, too many screens, too much sitting down. There are dietary things, like, you know, it could be gluten or, you know, whatever, some insensitivity in their gut, or there's a whole list of things that it could be looked into as explanations for what is going on in to create these attributes, characteristics, or personalities. And in some cases, if there is no underlying cause, if everything else in their health is perfect and their family and their environment, maybe that's just who they are. Mm. Maybe that's just their unique human, you know, personality. Yeah. What do you think?
I think you expressed that beautifully. I think you're right. I think you're right. And that is, yeah, it's just, I've said the quote and many people have heard it, but the whole idea that it's no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society, or even not even a profoundly sick society, but it's not necessarily a measure of health to be well adjusted to the society. It's not necessarily a measure of unhealth or a disorder if you don't fit into the structure of society. Because why aren't we deeming certain aspects of society as problematic instead of deeming the people problematic for not fitting in perfectly? Our societies are not perfectly designed. We aren't meeting all of our needs. There's so much that can be improved upon. So I wish I had more time to talk to you. I'll be totally candid and transparent that I'm going to go take my son to his wrestling practice. But I would love to hear more from you. We didn't get to.
Yeah, we can do a part two, maybe. Let's see.
Maybe we'll do a part two.
There might be some interesting questions.
Let's do that. Perfect. So yes, and in part two, maybe we'll talk more about what has happened since you stopped and how your life, as you told me, has improved with each year since you stopped. So maybe we'll focus on that and have a very solution-oriented, positive conversation. So yes, please. Audience members listening, submit questions in the comment section. If you're on YouTube, you can find contact information for me through YouTube. Some people are listening on Spotify, but you can find us on YouTube if you want to submit a question. And we'll have a part two for you in the relatively near future. So, my brave new friend, thank you.
I'll just finish with a joke because I've got this meme that someone sent me. So I don't mean this to all psychiatrists at all, just the ones that are pushing drugs on children. So psychiatrist personality disorder symptoms: forcing patients to take unapproved doses and excessive multi-drugging, risky behaviors, poor decision-making. 2, claiming only psychiatrists are capable of understanding studies, books, and academic sources. Grandiose delusions, inflated self-esteem. No matter how tragic results they witness, still defending their prescription. Obsession, psychosis.
Mm.
Being suspicious about patients that are not satisfied with their treatment and attributing side effects to their initial condition. Paranoia, irrational mistrust. And the last one, misleading patients about scientific facts and deceiving them with myths such as chemical imbalance theory. Mitomania, pathological lying.
That is brilliant.
Cool.
Let's end on that note. That just kind of encapsulates a lot of what we just talked about in an interesting way. So that's beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us and your expertise. Your story has clearly led you to educate yourself on the matter, and I appreciate you sharing your expertise with us. So to everyone listening, thank you for your precious attention, and tune into part 2 when it comes out.
Awesome. Thanks, Nick.
You're welcome. I'll contact you and we'll talk again soon.